collection of various people who kept abreast of such things. He met a man from Buffalo, New York, who claimed to have worked one time with Steinmetz, the dwarf immigrant genius of the General Electric Company. Physicists all over the world were discovering waves, the man told him. There was a tremendously important theory from abroad in which it was supposed matter and energy were but two aspects of the same primal force. That is my idea, too, the man told Houdini. He was a physicist with a university degree from Transylvania. All he needed was to devise the properly sensitive instrument, and primal waves could be detected and decoded that nobody as yet knew anything about. Houdini signed an agreement with him, giving him $2,000 for the exclusive rights to his research. Another man, a chemist, he established in the basement of his own home. Letters came to him from people claiming to have mediumistic gifts and asking for any item of his mother's, a brooch or a lock of hair, to work with. He employed a detective agency to look into the most reasonable sounding of these. He told the agents how to recognize spirit fraud. He told them about trumpets and trick photography, hidden recording megaphones, levitation of tables by means of pulleys. Why should a medium need the room dark, he told them. When he turns out the lights, it's to hide something. Soon Houdini had generated enough activity of this kind to make him think about working again. I'm feeling stronger, he told his manager. I'm beginning to feel like my old self. The bookings were soon arranged. Those who saw Houdini's performances in this period of his career say they surpassed anything he'd ever done. He brought masons on stage who built a brick wall 10 feet high, which he then walked through. He made a full-sized elephant disappear with the clap of his hands. Coins poured from his fingers. Doves flew from his ears. He stepped into a packing case previously examined by the audience. It was nailed shut and tied with a stout rope. No drape was set up in front of the packing case. It was pried open. It was empty. A collective gasp went up from the audience as Houdini was seen running into the theater from the lobby. He leaped on stage. His eyes seemed to gleam the color of blue diamonds. Slowly he lifted his arms. His feet rose from the floor. He stood 6 inches above the floor. Women panted. Suddenly he collapsed in a heap. There were exclamations of disbelief, followed by prolonged applause. His assistants helped him to a chair. Houdini asked for a glass of wine to restore his strength. He held the wine up in the spotlight. It turned colorless. He drank it. The wine glass disappeared from his hand. In fact, his performances were now of such intensity and had so strange and disquieting an effect on his audiences that in some cases children were hurried out before the end of the show. Houdini never noticed. He drove himself beyond his own physical capacity and would do 8 or 12 of his major tricks in a show that was supposed to have 3. He'd always billed his tricks as death-defying, and now reporters from the New York dailies, fully expecting him to overextend himself, followed him on his one-night stands from the Brooklyn Pantages to Fox's Union City to the Main Street Theater in New Rochelle. He did his famous milk can escape, in which he was padlocked in one of the ordinary 40-quart cans used to deliver milk to grocery stores. The can was filled with water. He had to escape or he would die. He lay in a glass tank shaped like a coffin, shown to be airtight, and in which a candle's flame could not be sustained. He lay in there sometimes for as much as 6 minutes after the candle went out. People shouted from the audience. Women closed their eyes and put their hands over their ears. They begged his assistants to stop him. When the pleas were finally heeded, the fitted top of the glass coffin made a popping sound as it came off. He was helped out shaking and covered with sweat. Every feat enacted Houdini's desire for his dead mother. He was buried and reborn, buried and reborn. One night, at a single performance only in New Rochelle, his wish for his own death was so apparent that people began to scream, and a local clergyman stood up and shouted, "Houdini, you are experimenting with damnation!" Perhaps it is true that he could no longer distinguish his life from his tricks. He stood in his long-belted robe, and glistening with sweat, his wet hair in spirals, he looked like a creature from another universe. "Ladies and gentlemen," he said, in an exhausted voice, "please forgive me." He wanted to explain his mastery of an ancient Eastern breathing regimen that allowed him to suspend his animation. He wanted to explain that his feats looked far more dangerous than they really were. He raised his hands in appeal, but at that moment there was an explosion of such force that the theater shook on its foundations and chunks of plaster fell from the proscenium arch, and the distracted and nerve-shattered audience, thinking it was another of his satanic tricks, retreated up the aisles in terror of him. Chapter 28. Actually, the blast occurred 2 miles away, at the borders of the city and its west end. The station house of the Emerald Isle engine had exploded, firing the field across the street with burning timbers and lighting the sky over Westchester. Companies from every section of the city responded, and from the adjoining communities of Pelham and Mount Vernon. Little could be done. Fortunately, the clapboard structure on Firehouse Lane was no closer than a quarter mile to the nearest residence. But two of the volunteers were in the hospital, one with burns so severe that he was not expected to live through the day, and at least 5 men were known to have been on duty at the time. It was the night of the week, Thursday, when the company gathered for its regular game of poker. By the following dawn, the field was scorched, and the building was a pile of charred ruins. The entire area had been roped off, and police detectives now began to go through the debris, recovering bodies and deducing from the evidence what it was that had caused the disaster. It soon became apparent that homicide had been committed. Of the 4 bodies recovered, 2 showed that not the fire or the explosion, but buckshot had been the cause of death. The matching horses were in harness and attached to the pumper, and they lay where they had fallen halfway into the street. The alarm signal machine was recovered from the ruins, showing that an alarm had been given from a box at the north end of town, yet there had been no other fire anywhere in the city that night. From this and several other bits of evidence, some secured with the help of a doctor of forensic medicine from the New York City Police Department, the following reconstruction was made. At approximately 10:30 p.m., 6 members of the engine company had been gathered in their quarters playing cards when the alarm rang. The card players scrambled into their boots and helmets. The horses were trotted out of their stalls and hitched to the steam engine. The harness was a special snap-on variety developed for fire horses by the P.A. Setzer Company of Hickory, North Carolina. Like all firemen, the Emerald Isle were proud of the speed with which they answered alarms. There was always a small fire going under the boiler so that the steam could be raised to full pressure by the time the apparatus arrived at the site. If the company were normally efficient on this evening, not 1 minute would have elapsed before the doors were swung open and the driver, holahing his horses, would have whipped them into the road. Someone was standing in the street directly in the engine's path. He or they were armed with shotguns, which were fired directly in the faces of the oncoming horses. 2 of the horses went down immediately. The 3rd reared, wounded in the neck so that its blood sprayed over the street like a fine rain. The driver of the rig was fatally shot and fell forward to the ground. Of the 3 firemen aboard, 2 incurred fatal wounds and a 3rd was crushed to death as the engine, pulled awry by the panicked horses, toppled over on its side. When the steam boiler went over, it made a terrible clang that was heard by residents in the neighborhood, already startled by the boom of guns. The firebox was scattered, and flaming coals ignited the clapboard firehouse. The blaze quickly grew, and the heat of the burning building exploded the boiler and sent burning timbers flying across the road into the field. That was the moment Houdini lost the affection of his audience. As it happened, the family had retired early that night. They had been sleeping poorly. The brown baby cried for his mother and did not take to the milk of a wet nurse. Father heard the distant explosion and, looking out of his bedroom window, saw the lighted sky. His first thought was that his plant with its store of fireworks had blown, but the glow was brightest in a different direction. It wasn't until the next morning that he learned what it was that had burned. The fire seemed to be the only topic of conversation throughout the city. At the lunch hour, Father went to the site. Crowds were standing at the police barriers. He circled the ropes and came to the pond at the bottom of the field across the road from the demolished firehouse. In the pond, the sunken structure of the Model T appeared and disappeared as the water, raised to a small chop by the prevailing breeze, erased and then reformed its wavering outlines. Father went home for the day, although the 12 noon whistle had only just blown. Mother could not look at him. She was seated with the baby on her lap. Her head was bent in a meditative attitude, unconsciously suggestive of the dead Sarah. Father wondered at this moment if their lives might no longer be under their control. At 4 in the afternoon, the newsboy ran by and tossed the folded evening paper to the porch. The killer arsonist was believed to be an unidentified Negro male. From his hospital bed, the sole survivor of the attack had been able to describe him to the police. Apparently, the Negro put out the fire burning the clothes of the injured man, and then, lest that be interpreted as an act of mercy, he had held his head by the hair and demanded to know where the fire chief was hiding. But it was Fire Chief Conklin's good fortune not to be at the station house that evening. It was not known how the Negro knew Conklin or what he had against him. The professional consensus was that there had to have been accomplices, this from the fact that a false alarm had been set to bring the volunteers out of the station. Nevertheless, an editorial described the disaster as the work of a lone crazed killer. Citizens were called upon to lock their doors and maintain their vigilance, but to remain calm. The family sat at the dinner table. Mother held the baby in her arms. Without realizing it, she did not now expect ever to put the child down. She felt the touch of his tiny fingertips on her cheek. Upstairs in his room, Grandfather groaned in pain. There was no dinner this evening. Nobody wanted to eat. A cut glass carafe of brandy was set in front of Father. He was drinking his third glass. He felt that something, some sort of small bone or piece of dust, was lodged in his throat, and he had conceived of the brandy as the only thing that would fix it. He had taken from his bureau drawer his old army pistol from the Philippine campaign. It lay on the table. "We are suffering a tragedy that should not have been ours," he said to his wife. "What in God's name possessed you on that day? The county has facilities for indigence. You took her in without sufficient thought. You victimized us all with your foolish female sentimentality." Mother regarded him. She could not remember any time in their long acquaintance when he had reproached her. She knew he would apologize. Nevertheless, tears filled her eyes and eventually ran down her face. Wisps of her hair had come undone and lay on her neck and over her ears. Father looked at her, and she was beautiful in the way she had been as a girl. He did not realize the pleasure he felt in having made her cry. Younger brother was sitting with his elbow on the arm of his chair and his head propped in his hand. His index finger was extended and pointed at his temple. He watched his brother-in-law. "Are you going to find him and shoot him?" he said. "I'm going to protect my home," Father said. "This is his child here. If he makes the mistake of coming to my door, I will deal with him." "But why should he come here?" brother said in a goading tone of voice. "We did not desecrate his car." Father looked at mother. "In the morning I will go to the police and have to tell them this murdering madman was a guest in my home. I will have to tell them we are keeping his bastard child." Younger brother said, "I think Coalhouse Walker Jr. would want you to tell the police everything you know. You can tell him he's the same Negro maniac whose car is lying at the bottom of Firehouse Pond. You can tell him he's the fellow who visited their own headquarters to make a complaint against Will Conklin and his thugs. You can tell him he's the same crazed black killer who sat by the bedside of someone who died in the hospital of her injuries." Father said, "I hope I misunderstand you. Would you defend the savage? Does he have anyone but himself to blame for Sarah's death? Anything but his damnable nigger pride? Nothing under heaven can excuse the killing of men and the destruction of property in this manner." Brother stood so abruptly that his chair fell over. The baby started and began to cry. Brother was pale and trembling. "I did not hear such a eulogy at Sarah's funeral," he said. "I did not hear you say then that death and the destruction of property was inexcusable." But the fact was that Coalhouse Walker had already taken several steps to identify himself with the crime. It turned out that within an hour of the explosion, he or some other black man left identical letters at the offices of the two local newspapers. The editors, after conferring with the police, chose not to print them. The letters were written in a clear, firm hand and told of the events leading up to the attack on the firehouse. "I want the infamous fire chief of the volunteers turned over to my justice," the letter said. "I want my automobile returned to me in its original condition. If my demands are not met, I will continue to kill firemen and burn firehouses until they are. I will destroy the entire city if need be." The newspaper editors and police officials believed it was in the interest of the public welfare not to print the letter. An isolated crazed killer was one problem, an insurrection was another. Squads of police quietly went through the Negro neighborhoods and asked questions about Coalhouse Walker Jr. At the same time, police of neighboring towns with Negro populations did the same. To headquarters, the word filtered back, "Not one of our Negroes, not one of ours." In the morning, Father took the North Avenue streetcar downtown. He strode to City Hall. He went in the door a widely respected businessman in the community. His career as an explorer had been well reported in the newspapers. The flag that flew from the cupola on top of the building had been his gift to the city. Part 3, Chapter 29. Father had been born and raised in White Plains, New York. He was an only child. He remembered moments of light and warmth in the days of summer at Saratoga Springs. There were gardens there with paths of washed gravel. He would stroll with his mama down the large painted porches of the great hotels. On the same day every year they went home. She was a frail woman who died when he was 14. Father attended Groton and then Harvard. He read German philosophy. In the winter of his sophomore year his studies ended. His father had made a fortune in the Civil War and had since used his time, losing it in unwise speculations. It was now entirely gone. The old man was the sort who thrived on adversity. His confidence rose with every loss. In bankruptcy, he was beaming and triumphant. He died suddenly, all his expectations intact. His flamboyance had produced in his lonely son a personality that was cautious, sober, industrious, and chronically unhappy. Coming into his majority, the orphan took the few dollars left to him and invested it in a small fireworks business owned by an Italian. Eventually he took it over, expanded its sales, bought out a flag manufacturing firm, and became quite comfortable. He had also found the time to secure an army commission in the Philippine campaigns. He was proud of his life, but never forgot that before going into business he had been to Harvard. He had heard William James lecture on the principles of modern psychology. Exploration became his passion. He wanted to avoid what the great Dr. James had called the habit of inferiority to the full self. Now every morning Father rose and tasted his mortal being. He wondered if his dislike for Coalhouse Walker, which had been instantaneous, was based not on the man's color, but on his being engaged in an act of courtship, a suspenseful enterprise that suggested the best of life was yet to come. Father noted the skin mottling on the back of his hand. He found himself occasionally asking people to repeat to him what they'd said. His bladder seemed always to demand emptying. Mother's body did not arouse his lust, only his quiet appreciation. He admired her shape and softness, but was no longer inflamed. He noted that she had grown heavier in the upper arms. Once accustomed to life together after his return from the Arctic, they had slipped into an undemanding companionship in which he felt bypassed by life like a spectator in an event. He found distasteful her promotion of the black girl's marriage, and now that Sarah was dead, he felt altogether invisible, mother's grief having directed her intention solely on Sarah's boy. He recognized that he took satisfaction in going to the police. It was not an entirely righteous feeling. Perhaps in compensation, he represented Coalhouse as a peaceful man driven mad by circumstances not of his own doing. This was exactly the argument younger brother made at home. Father confirmed the account of events in Coalhouse's letter. He was a pianist, Father said, using the historical tense. He was always courteous and correct in his dealings. The police nodded gravely. They wanted to know if the Negro was likely to strike again. That is what the police chief said, strike again. Father said that once Coalhouse had set a course for himself, he was nothing if not persevering. Largely upon this advice, a defense was organized. Police guards were assigned to all the firehouses in the city. The main roads were placed under watch. In the headquarters, a wall map was installed showing the deployment of forces. On the basis of Father's information, the New York City Police Department was persuaded to assign detectives to look for Cole House in Harlem. Father had expected criticism from the police. This was not forthcoming. They regarded him as an expert on the character of the criminal. They encouraged him to spend as much time at headquarters as he could. They wanted him to be on hand for the deliberations. The walls of the rooms were painted light green to a line at waist level, dark green below. There were cuspidors in every corner. Father agreed to make himself as available as he could. This was his busiest time of year. All the orders for rockets, sparklers, Roman candles, crackers, flares, and bombs had to be shipped in time for the 4th of July celebrations. He went back and forth between his office and the police. To his disgust, he found himself at the station in the company of the Emerald Isle chief, Will Conklin. Conklin smelled of whiskey, and the experience of being a hunted man had turned his florid face the color of veal. He was by turn bombastic and craven. He offered counsel of the same level of wisdom that had triggered the crisis in the first place. He wanted to go to the black neighborhood and clean all the niggers out once and for all. The officers heard this with disinterest. "We may have to give you to the boogeyman, Willie," they said, "just to get some peace around here." Conklin could take little of this. "Are we not in this together?" he said. "God love you, you were cruel lads at St. Catherine's, and you're cruel now." "Willie," the police chief said, "we had to wait to hear from the black man himself that one of your shenanigans is what started this, you dumb mick, telling us now we're in this together." But the fire chief's character and mentality seemed appropriate to the place. There was a constant traffic through the glass doors of felons, lawyers, bondsmen, policemen, and hapless relatives. Drunks were brought in by the collar, and thieves with their hands cuffed. Voices were loud, and language was vile. Conklin owned a coal and ice business and lived with a wife and several children in an apartment over his yard office. It dawned on Father that the man was spending so much time at the police station because he felt safe there. Of course, he would not admit it. He boasted of the precautions he had taken at his yard. Not relying on the two posted policemen, he had enlisted all the survivors of the Emerald Isle to billet themselves at his place. They were armed. The nigger might as well attack West Point, he said. Father felt demeaned by the man. Conklin spoke to him differently from the way he addressed the policeman. His diction improved. His assumption of social equality was galling. "It's a tragic thing, Captain," he would say. "A tragic thing indeed." Once he actually put his hand on Father's shoulder, a gesture of such alarming brotherhood that it felt like an electric shock. Nevertheless, Father found himself spending more and more time here. He found it difficult to go home. On the day of the mass funeral for the victims of the Emerald Isle fire, he went to hear the eulogies. Half the city turned out. A large brass cross swayed over the heads of the crowd. Will Conklin did not leave the police station. "I'd be a perfect target for the rifle shot," he said. Questions about his behavior began to circulate through the city. Then the news that the killings of the night of the Emerald Isle stemmed from a grievance was published in the New York City dailies, where reporters were not constrained by the interests of the local chamber of commerce. The World and the Sun printed the text of Cole House's letter. Will Conklin became a despised person everywhere. He was hated as the stupid perpetrator of events leading to the death of men whom he ostensibly commanded. On the other hand, among certain elements, he was scorned as someone who knew how to bait a negro, but not to put the fear of God into him. A man wearing a derby now sat in a car every day up the street from the house on Broadview Avenue. Father had not been officially told of this, but he advised Mother that he had asked for a police court, feeling it would be less wise to share with her his speculation that for all their gratitude at his coming forward, the police weren't entirely above keeping an eye on him. He wondered what suspicion they might be entertaining. Exactly 1 week after Cole House's attack on the Emerald Isle, at 6 in the morning, a white town car drove slowly up Railroad Place, a narrow cobblestone street in the West End. In the middle of the block was Municipal Fire Station No. 2. As the car drew abreast of the building, it stopped, and the two policemen standing sleepily before the doors were astounded to see several black men disembark holding shotguns and rifles. One of the policemen had the presence of mind to drop to the ground. The other just stood open-mouthed as the raiders efficiently formed a line like a firing squad and, upon signal, fired their weapons in unison. The blast killed the standing policeman and shattered the window panes of the firehouse doors. One of the Negroes then ran up and tossed several small packages through the broken windows. The man who had given the command to fire came up to the terrified survivor lying on the sidewalk. He placed a letter in his hand and said calmly, "This must be published in the newspaper." Then he joined the other Negroes who had returned to the car. As it drove off, two or perhaps three explosions, coming one on top of another, blew out the doors of the firehouse and instantly turned it into an inferno. The flames quickly engulfed an adjoining saloon and the establishment of a coffee distributor who also roasted his blends for customers off the street. The sacks of beans produced a yellow pall and left a fragrance of roasted coffee over the neighborhood for several weeks. Eventually, four bodies were recovered, all of city firemen. An elderly woman, presumably dead of fright, was found in her rooms across the way. A Rio fire engine and an ambulance were destroyed. And now the city was truly in panic. Children did not appear for school. Cries of outrage were directed against the city administration and against Willie Conklin. A delegation of firemen marched to City Hall and demanded to be sworn in as police deputies and given arms to defend themselves. The flustered mayor sent a telegram to the governor of New York appealing for help. The story of Cole House's second attack made the front pages of every newspaper in the country. Reporters in droves came up from New York. The chief of police was condemned for allowing the black killer to do his murderous work again. The chief made a statement to reporters gathered in his office. "The man uses automobiles to get around," he said. "He strikes and disappears, God knows where. For several years, the Association of Police Chiefs of the State of New York has passed a resolution calling for the licensing of automobiles and automobilists. If that were the law today, we could track the brute down." The chief, as he spoke, emptied the drawers of his desk. He puffed a cigar. He walked out with the reporters. The next day, a bill to license automobiles was introduced in the state legislature. Father employed two Negroes at his manufactory. One is a janitor, the other is an assembler of rocket tubes. Neither reported to work the day of the second disaster. In fact, Negroes were to be seen nowhere in the city. They stayed home behind locked doors. That night, police arrested on the street several white citizens carrying pistols and rifles. The governor responded to the mayor's appeal by sending in two companies of militia from New York City. They arrived the next morning and immediately set up their tents on the baseball field behind the high school. Children gathered to watch. Special editions of the local papers were published, and each carried prominently the text of Cole House's second letter. This is what it said. 1. That the white excrescence known as Willie Conklin be turned over to my justice. 2. That the Model T Ford with its custom pantasote top be returned in its original condition. Until these demands are satisfied, let the rules of war prevail. Cole House Walker, Jr., President, Provisional American Government. At this point, everyone's most urgent need was to know what Cole House Walker looked like. The newspapers competed fiercely. Newsmen stormed the offices of the Clef Club Orchestra in Harlem. There were no pictures to be had that included the face of the infamous pianist. Hearst's American triumphantly went to press with a portrait of the composer Scott Joplin. Friends of Joplin threatened to sue, the composer being in the last stages of a terminal illness and unable to see to his own interests. Apologies were tendered. Finally, a newspaper in St. Louis came up with a picture that was reprinted widely. Father recognized it to be accurate. It showed a somewhat younger Cole House sitting at an upright piano in white tie and tails. His hands were on the keyboard, and he was smiling for the camera. Grouped around the piano were a banjo player, a cornetist, a trombonist, a violinist, and a drummer bent over a snare drum. They were all in white tie. They were posed as if playing, but were clearly not. A circle was drawn around Cole House's head. This became the standard photo. The ironies of a smiling black man with a neat mustache, an altogether cheerful and forthright physiognomy, were too delicious for the caption writers to resist. "Smile of a killer," they said, "or the president of the Provisional American Government in happier days." Under the intense and widespread investigation by the press, the family's role in the entire affair could not be kept hidden. Reporters, first in ones and twos, later in larger groups, began to knock on the door, and then, being refused admittance, to camp outside under the Norwegian maples. They wanted to see the brown child. They wanted statements of any kind about Kohlhaas and his visits to Sarah. They peeked through the windows of the parlor and came around to the kitchen door to try the lock. They wore straw boaters and carried pads in their pockets. They chewed tobacco and spit it on the ground and crushed cigarettes under their heels in the grass. Pictures of the house appeared in the New York papers. There were inaccurate accounts of father's explorations. The blinds were drawn, and the boy was not allowed to go out. The house was stifling, and in the night grandfather moaned in his sleep. Mother might have withstood all of this if a debate did not rise concerning the family sheltering of Kohlhaas Walker's son. A steady parade of cars came up the hill in the long evenings as sightseers craned their necks for a glimpse of a face in the window. An official of the Child Welfare Board in New York gave the opinion that the still unchristened illegitimate child should be given over to one of the excellent asylums that existed for the care of orphans, waifs, and children born out of wedlock. Mother kept the baby in her room. She would no longer take him downstairs. She enlisted her son to watch over him when she had to see to something. She did not take the time to put her hair up, but let it hang to her shoulders all day. She was uncharacteristic in her bitterness toward father. "Why don't you unlock your treasure chest," she said, "and get me some proper help?" This was a reference to his financial conservatism, which she had never before questioned. Always they had lived less well than he could afford. Father was stung by the remark, but he went out and found a woman to do the cooking and another woman to be laundress and housemaid, both to live in. He hired the man who had been the part-time gardener and installed him in the rooms above the garage stable. Grandfather already had a registered nurse to tend to him in the day. The house, under siege, now bustled like a wartime camp. The boy was constantly admonished to get out from under people's feet. He watched his mother pace her room, her hands clasped in front of her, her unbound hair hanging down the sides of her face. She looked gaunt, and her chin, which had always inclined to roundness, seemed ungenerous, even pointed. It was clear the crisis was driving the spirit from their lives. Father had always felt secretly that as a family they were touched by an extra light. He felt it going now. He felt stupid and plodding, available simply to have done to him what circumstances would do. Kohlhaas ruled. Yet he had been to the Arctic, to Africa, to the Philippines. He had traveled out west. Did that mean only that more and more of the world resisted his intelligence? He sat in his study. Everyone he thought about, even grandfather, he saw in terms of his own failed concern. He had treated grandfather with the arrogant courtesy one gives to the senile even before the condition had set in. From younger brother he was completely estranged. Toward his wife he felt drastically slipped in her estimation, an explorer in body only, the spirit trapped in his own father's prejudices. He was beginning to look like him, too, going dry and juiceless in everything, with a mad glint showing in the corner of his eye. Why did that have to be? He condemned himself most for the neglect of his son. He never talked to the boy or offered his companionship. He had always relied on his presence in the child's life as a model for emulation. How smug that was, how stupid, as the tactic of a man who had acted in his life to distinguish himself from his own father. He looked for the boy, and found him on the floor of his room, reading in the evening paper an account of the successful play of the New York Baseball Nine under the masterful coaching of John J. McGraw. "Would you like to see that team?" he said. The boy looked up startled. "I was just thinking of it," he said. Father went to Mother's room. "Tomorrow," he announced, "I am taking the boy to see a game of baseball." He said this with such resolve in its rightness that she was checked in her response, which was to condemn him for an idiot, and when he left the room she could only wonder that she had had that thought in the first place, so separated from any feeling of love. Chapter 30. The next afternoon, when father and son left the house, two reporters followed them part of the way on their brisk walk to the railroad station on Quaker Ridge Road. "We're going to the Giants baseball game," Father advised them. "That's all I will say." "Who's pitching?" one of the reporters asked. "Rube Marquard," the boy said. "He's won his last three chances." Just as they reached Quaker Ridge, a train pulled in. This was the New York, Westchester, and Boston Railway. It did not go anywhere near Boston, nor did it provide service all the way to New York, but it gave a smooth ride to the Bronx and left them with a trolley connection, the 155th Street crosstown, which went over the Harlem River to the Polo Grounds at Coogan's Bluff. It was a fine afternoon. Large white clouds moved briskly under a clear blue sky. As the trolley came across the bridge, they could see on the bluff overlooking the wooden stands several huge trees which, lacking leaves even in this season, supported derbied figures of men who preferred not to pay to enter the park but to watch the game festooned in the branches like black flowers swaying in the wind. Father caught some of the boy's excitement. He was immensely pleased to be out of New Rochelle. When they reached the park, crowds were streaming down the stairs from the L. Cabs were pulling up and discharging their passengers. Newsboys were hawking programs of the game, and there was a raucous energy everywhere in the street. Horns blew. The overhead tracks of the L left the street mottled with sun. Father bought the expensive 50-cent admission, then paid extra for a box, and they entered the park and took their seats behind first base in the lower of the two decks, where the sun would for an inning or two cause them to shade their eyes. The Giants were dressed in their baggy white uniforms with black pinstripes. The manager, McGraw, wore a heavy black cardigan over his barrel trunk with the letters NY emblazoned on the left sleeve. He was short and pugnacious. Like his team, he wore socks with thick horizontal stripes and the small flat cap with a peak and a button on the crown. The opponents of the afternoon were the Boston Braves, whose dark blue flannels were buttoned to the neck with the collar turned up. A brisk wind blew the dirt of the field. The game began, and almost immediately Father regretted the seats he had chosen. The player's every ragging curse could be heard clearly by his son. The team at bat shouted obscene taunts at the opposing pitcher. McGraw himself, the paternal figure and commander of his team, stood at third base, unleashing the most constant and creative string of vile epithets of anyone. His strident caw could be heard throughout the park. The crowd seemed to match him in its passions. The game was close, with first one team, then the other assuming the lead. A runner sliding into second base upended the Giants' second baseman, who rose howling, limping in circles, and bleeding profusely through his stocking. Both teams came running from their dugouts, and the game was stopped for some minutes while everyone fought and rolled in the dirt, and the crowd yelled its encouragement. An inning or two after the fight, the Giant pitcher Marquard seemed to lose his control and threw the ball so that it hit the Boston batsman. This fellow rose from the ground and ran out toward Marquard, waving his bat. Again the dugouts emptied, and the players wrestled with each other and threw their roundhouse punches and beat clouds of dust into the air. The audience this time participated by throwing soda pop bottles onto the field. Father consulted his program. On the Giants' side were Merkel, Doyle, Myers, Snodgrass, and Herzog, among others. The Boston team boasted a player named Rabbit Marinville, a shortstop who he noted roamed his position bent over with his hands at the end of his long arms grazing the grass in a manner that would more properly be called simian. There was a first baseman named Butch Schmidt, and others with the names of Cochran, Moran, Hess, Rudolph, which led inevitably to the conclusion that professional baseball was played by immigrants. When play was resumed, he studied each batsman. Indeed, they seemed to be clearly from the mills and farms, rude-featured, jug-eared men, sunburned and ham-handed, cheeks bulging with tobacco chew, their intelligence completely absorbed in the effort of the game. In the field, the players wore outsized flapping leather gloves, which made them look like half-dressed clowns. The dry dust of the diamond was splotched with expectorant. Woe to the campaigns of the Anti-Spitting League and the example of these men. On the Boston side, the boy who picked up the bats and replaced them in the dugout was upon second look a midget in a team uniform like the rest, but proportionately minute. His shouts and taunts were piped in soprano. Most of the players who came to bat at first touched him on the head, a gesture he seemed to invite so that Father realized it was a kind of good luck ritual. On the Giant side, it was no midget, but a strange skinny man whose uniform was ill-fitting, who had weak eyes that did not align properly, and who seemed to shadow the game in a lethargic pantomime of his own solitude, pitching imaginary balls more or less in time to the real pitches. He looked like a dirt-eater. He waved his arm in complete circles like a windmill turns. Father began to watch the game less than he did this unfortunate creature, obviously a team pet like the Boston Midget. During dull moments of the game, the crowd yelled to him and applauded his antics. Sure enough, he was listed in the program as mascot. His name was Charles Victor Faust. He was clearly a fool who, for imagining himself one of the players, was kept on the team roster for their amusement. Father remembered the baseball at Harvard 20 years before, when the players addressed each other as Mr. and played their game avidly, but as sportsmen in sensible uniforms before audiences of collegians who rarely numbered more than 100. He was disturbed by his nostalgia. He'd always thought of himself as progressive. He believed in the perfectibility of the Republic. He thought, for instance, there was no reason the Negro could not, with proper guidance, carry every burden of human achievement. He did not believe in aristocracy, except of the individual effort and vision. He felt his father's loss of fortune had the advantage of saving him from the uncritical adoption of the prejudices of his class. But the air in this ballpark, open under the sky, smelled like the back room of a saloon. Cigar smoke filled the stadium, and lit by the oblique rays of the afternoon sun, indicated the voluminous cavern of air in which he sat pressed upon as if by a foul universe, with the breathless wind of a 10,000-throated chorus in his ears, shouting its praise and abuse. Out in center field, behind the unroofed or bleacher seats, a great display board indicated the number of outs and the inning and the hits and runs made. A man went along a scaffold and hung the appropriate marked shingles that summarized the action. Father sank into his chair. As the afternoon wore on, he entertained the illusion that what he saw was not baseball, but an elaborate representation of his own problems, accounted for his secret understanding in the coded clarity of numbers that could be seen from a distance. He turned to his son. "What is it you like about this game?" he said. The boy did not remove his gaze from the diamond. "The same thing happens over and over," he said. "The pitcher throws the ball so as to fool the batter into thinking he can hit it." "But sometimes the batter does hit it," the father said. "Then the pitcher is the one who is fooled," the boy said. At this moment the Boston hurler, Hub Perdue, threw a pitch which the New York batter, Red Jack Murray, swung at. The ball soared into the air in a high, narrow arc and seemed then to stop in its trajectory. With a start, father realized it was coming directly at them. The boy jumped up and held out his hands, and there was a cheer behind them as he stood with the leather-covered spheroid resting in his palms. For one instant everyone in the park looked in their direction. Then the fool with the weak eyes, who imagined he was a player on the team, came up to the fence in front of them and stared at the boy, his arms and hands twitching in his baggy flannel shirt. His hat was absurdly small for his abnormally large head. The boy held out the ball to him, and gently, with a smile almost sane, he accepted it. An interesting note is that this poor fellow, Charles Victor Faust, was actually called upon to pitch one inning in a game toward the end of the same season when the Giants had already won the pennant and were in a carefree mood. For a moment his delusion that he was a big leaguer fused with reality. Soon thereafter the players became bored with him, and he was no longer regarded as a good luck charm by manager McGraw. His uniform was confiscated, and he was unceremoniously sent on his way. He was remanded to an insane asylum, and some months later died there. Chapter 31. At the end of the ball game, a great anxiety came over father. He felt it had been stupid to leave his wife alone. But as they left the park, borne by the streaming crowd, he realized his son had taken his hand. He felt an uplift of his spirit. On the open trolley, he put his arm around the boy's shoulders. Arriving in New Rochelle, they walked briskly from the train station, and when they came in the door, they gave a loud hello, and for the first time in days, father felt like himself. Mother appeared from the back of the house. Her hair was bound, she was groomed and smiling and neat. She embraced him and said, "Look, I have something to show you." Her face was radiant. She stepped aside, and walking down the hall, holding the hand of the housemaid, with Sarah's child in his nightshirt, he tottered and swung against her skirt, righted himself, and looked at Father in triumph. Everyone laughed. "We can't hold him," Mother said. "He wants to walk everywhere." The boy knelt and held out his arms, and the child shook his hand free of the housemaid and lurched toward him, picking up speed as he went, outracing his instability and falling happily against the boy's chest. A kind of resolute serenity carried them through the evening. In the quiet of Mother's room toward midnight, she and Father discussed everything on their minds. The chances were that Kohlhaas would continue for some time to elude capture. In that case, they foresaw a community from which they would be increasingly alienated. Already, a few of Mother's acquaintances from her service league had reacted to the publicity given the family. She dreaded actions of spite and bitterness in which Sarah's baby would be taken away under protection of a vengeful authority. Father could not deny that might happen. But they were in this moment so calmly in possession of themselves that there was no need for false assurances or for either of them to dissemble an optimism not truly felt. Father said he would not put it past the authorities to decide to use the child in some way to persuade Kohlhaas to surrender. "What we have to do," Father said, "is get away." "But how can we?" Mother said. "My father is invalided. School is not yet out. We have just taken on the responsibilities of a household staff." Each of these problems she enumerated, with her right index finger tolling the fingers of her left hand. So she had been thinking the same thing, and Father now perceived that she awaited his solutions in good faith. He told her to leave everything to him. His assumption of responsibility produced in her warm feelings of gratitude. Their conversation reminding them that they were after all friends of long standing, they went to bed and spent the night together. She let him make love to her, responding with such cooperative huggings and movements of her hips, and with so many caresses of encouragement to represent her best wishes to have him succeed in his efforts, that he felt for the first time in many months she appreciated she had a good man in her arms. The answer to everything seemed to be Atlantic City. Father located a fine hotel there, the Breakers, which had available a suite of rooms facing the ocean for something less than would be expected, the season having barely begun. The South Jersey shore was easy to reach, a few hours by rail, not too near, but not too far to keep him from going back Sunday evening as his business dictated. The change of air would do everyone good. Grandfather's doctor, who had submitted him to the latest orthopedic procedure for broken hips, a metallic pin implanted like an internal splint, advised them that he should be on his crutches or in his chair as much as possible, bed rest comprising the greatest danger for one his age. The boy would have to leave school a few weeks early, but was so adept at his studies that this was not considered a serious disadvantage. The house would not be closed with the covering up of furniture and shutting off of rooms as required, but maintained with the staff for those periods in which Father would have to be in New Rochelle. The housekeeper would stay with Mother at the shore. She was a stolid, conscientious Negro woman who would provide, in addition, the obvious and erroneous explanation for the presence of a brown child in their party. Thus armed with a plan of action, the family prepared for their departure. They maintained a good cheer that became almost hysterical as the situation grew in its ugliness. The new police chief, a retired inspector from the New York City Department of Homicide, proposed lines of investigation that were ominous. His first day on the job, he told reporters that the explosive used on Municipal Station No. 2 was very sophisticated, a combination of gun cotton and fulminate of mercury that could only have been concocted by someone who knew his stuff, which Kohlhaas Walker, a piano player, did not. He asked where the Negro got the money for the car he used, or for the assistance of a gang of colored men, all armed and all presumably motivated by hard cash. He has to pay his cohorts. He has expenses. Where does he get his money? Where does he stay between his mad raids on this gentle city? I know a half dozen Reds I would love to have in detention here. I bet I would get some of my answers. These remarks, which were widely disseminated, had in their suggestion of a conspiracy of radicals the worst possible effect on an already agitated townspeople. Militia patrolled the streets. There were several instances of abusive Negroes who were seen out of their neighborhoods. There was a rash of false alarms from fireboxes all over the city, each bringing out engines with police guards and a convoy of reporters in cars. Reporters were everywhere, and along with the troopers and the highly visible police in their wagons, produced in the community a painfully swollen sense of itself. The churches on Sunday mornings had never known such crowds. The hospital emergency room reported a higher-than-usual number of household accident victims. People were burning themselves, cutting themselves, tripping on rugs, and falling down flights of stairs. Several men were brought in with gun wounds inflicted in the cleaning and handling of old weapons. Meanwhile, the press seemed to be ahead of the authorities in dealing with the specifics of Kohlhaas's letters. Probably for the pictures it would make, they agitated for several editions to raise the Model T from Firehouse Pond. This was finally done. A crane was moved to the site, and the automobile was brought up like a monstrous artifact, mud dripping from its tires, water and slime pouring out of its hood. It was swung over to the bank and deposited on the ground for everyone to see. But now the authorities were embarrassed. The Ford stood as tangible proof of the black man's grievance. Waterlogged and wrecked, it offended the sensibilities of anyone who respected machines and valued what they could do. After its picture was published, people began to come to see it in such numbers that the police had to cordon off the area. Feeling that they had compromised themselves, the mayor and the board of aldermen issued a new series of condemnations of the colored madman and said that to negotiate with him in any way at all, to face him with less than an implacable demand that he surrender himself, would be to invite every renegade and radical and black man in the country to flout the law and spit on the American flag. Even if there was at this point a public demand for a strategy of negotiation, which there was not even the press suggested it, no one could have had any idea how to get in touch with the killer. Kohlhaas had not announced how much time he granted them till the next attack. Indeed, there was an opinion delivered by an alienist hired by the New York World that the second of the letters, signed Kohlhaas Walker, President, Provisional American Government, was much advanced beyond the first in its signals of mental deterioration, and that to deal with someone in the throes of a progressive delusionary madness as if he were open to reason would be a tragic mistake. However, it was left to the plain citizenry of New Rochelle to come up with the most practical idea for dealing with the problem. From every neighborhood and every class, the cry arose for Willie Conklin to leave town. Some irate citizens even communicated with Conklin himself. He brought into police headquarters several unsigned letters delivered to his mailbox, all suggesting that if he did not pack up and leave New Rochelle, they, the writers, would do Kohlhaas Walker's job for him. Like all of Conklin's moves, sharing his correspondence with the authorities was a mistake. It did not generate their sympathy as he had hoped, but simply made up their minds to sponsor the idea. From the beginning, Conklin had been unable to understand how anyone who was white could feel for him less than the most profound admiration. The more unpopular he became, the more piteous his bewilderment. The miserable fellow understood nothing, and saw the public outcry for his exile not in its larger strategy as a means of diffusing the situation, nor even in the small as a means perhaps of saving his own life. He felt martyred by what he called the nigger lovers, even though these now seemed to constitute virtually the entire population of the city. He drank himself into a state of torpor and became dumbly complacent as his wife and associates made arrangements for their departure. Thus, with no one completely in command of the situation, with municipal authorities, police, state militia, and citizenry all nervous and unsure in their continuing vulnerability to the black guerrilla, two things were caused to happen more or less by public consensus that were roughly analogous to a recognition of his demands. The Model T Ford had been raised, possibly foretelling some kind of negotiation, and he could read if he was in range of the New Rochelle papers, both of which gave the largest headlines in their history to the intelligence, that the Conklin family had gone into hiding in New York City. No concessions had been made, and the streets bristled with military and paramilitary deployments, but the situation was altered. Let him now burn down the entire metropolis of New York, one editorial said, or accept the principle that any man who takes the law into his own hands places himself against a civilized and resolute people and defames the very justice he seeks to enforce. In contrast to all of this, the family's departure was private and unreported. Father contracted with the Railway Express to transport their baggage, a matching pair of wicker trunks he had bought for the occasion, each with several drawers and compartments and a commodious closet for hanging clothes, a brass-studded footlocker, and several suitcases and hatboxes, and they rode out of New Rochelle on a train that came through at the crack of dawn. Later that morning in New York, they made connections with an Atlantic City train in Pennsylvania Station. This was the station designed by the firm of Stanford White and Charles McKim. Its stone colonnade facades, modeled on the Roman baths at Caracalla, spanned 31st to 33rd Street and 7th to 8th Avenue. Porters helped with grandfather's wheelchair. Mother was wearing a white ensemble. The laundress held Sarah's child. The station on the inside was so vast that although it was filled with people, their voices were no more than a murmur. The boy gazed at the roof, an exposition of corrugated green glass vaults and arches supported by steel ribs and needle-like steel columns. The light fell through this roof like a soft crystal dust. Descending to the concourse of trains, he looked right and left and saw as far as he could see in either direction the encouraged locomotives waiting in an impatience of steam and shouts and tolling bells to be released on their journeys. Chapter 32. And what of younger brother? His absence from home since his passionate defense of Coal House had caused no undue concern. They were used to his sullen temper. He appeared intermittently at the flag and fireworks plant. He drew his salary. He was not on hand for their departure, and so Mother sealed a note and left it on the table in the front hall. The note was never claimed. Some days after the attack on the firehouse, younger brother had gone back to the Harlem funeral parlor from which Sarah had been buried. He was met at the door by the proprietor. "I should very much like to speak with Mr. Coal House Walker," younger brother said. "I shall wait every evening under the arcade of the Manhattan Casino until he is satisfied that it is safe to receive me." The mortician listened impassively and gave no sign that he knew what younger brother was talking about. Nevertheless, every evening thereafter, the young man stood at the casino, enduring the stares of the black patrons and timing the intervals between trains of the 8th Avenue L that periodically rumbled past the building. The weather was warm, and through the ornate glass doors of the theater, which were open some time after the evening concert began, he could hear strains of the syncopated music of Jim Europe and the applause of the audience. Of course, Coal House had quit his orchestra job and moved out of his rooms weeks before his attack on the firehouse. To the police who tried to trace him, it was as if he had never existed. On the fourth night of younger brother's vigil, a well-dressed colored youth approached him and asked him for a dime. Hiding his astonishment that someone so well turned out should beg for a coin, he dug in his pocket and produced it. The fellow smiled and said he seemed to have more change than that. Could he manage another quarter? Younger brother looked in his eyes and saw there the intelligent appraisal of someone empowered to make a decision. The next night he looked for the colored fellow but did not see him. Instead, he became aware of someone else standing under the arcade after the audience had gone inside. He too was a young man in a suit and tie with a derby upon his head. He suddenly began to walk away, and younger brother impulsively followed him. He followed him along the streets of shabby row houses, across intersections paved in brick, down alleys and around corners. He was aware of going down several streets more than once. Finally, on a quiet side street, he followed him down under the front steps of a brownstone to a basement door. The door was open. He stepped inside and went through a short hall to another door, and found himself facing Coal House, who was seated at a table with his arms crossed. The room was otherwise bare of